No running for political office doing meet and greet. If you want to run for mayor, you got to do it a different time, right? Hey, I was told, by the way, we need some more people to volunteer for the chili cook-off. We are short on the chili we think that we'll need. So sign up in the Welcome Center, if you will. If you have any talent there, you know, they don't do any testing. You could probably win that contest with store-bought chili if you had a mind to. So, all right. Hey, I want to begin this morning to talk to you on the subject of marriage and singleness. And the question is why? And the quick answer is because the Bible talks about being married and single. And so as a pastor, you're obliged to speak on everything that's in Scripture. But I think secondly, because it is an area that many people struggle with. And unfortunately, if you struggle in the area of accepting your place as a single person at this time in your life, or if you struggle in your marriage, I think it puts you at a place where you are vulnerable to the tempter, because behind all temptation is a tempter. And if you think about it like this, if you have temptation that comes from a tempter, where are you most likely to be tempted at? In other words, where would you be most vulnerable to temptation? And I think that the answer is at least in my life, it's in those prolonged periods that you see people go through of disappointment, of despair, of sometimes of even regret for the decision that they've made. But it's really in those long, dry places that I think temptation becomes a significant problem. I think there's a reason maybe that Jesus was tempted in the wilderness. In the dry place, he had temptation that he did not experience previous to that. And I think there's nothing more, there's no greater challenge, let me say this, that will come to you that will produce those long periods of disappointment, of depression, if you will. There's nothing that produces that more than relationship issues. I mean, if you're single and you don't want to be single and you've been the bridesmaid once too often, that period of being in a place that you don't want to be for a long period of time, it makes you really ripe for temptation. Conversely, if you're in a marriage and the problems linger, the problems continue, there's a disconnect happening in that relationship, again, that leaves you open, I think, for a period of great temptation. Temptations to really addictions, temptations to stray in a variety of ways. And so, if you're going to build a wall as high as you can get it against temptation, you'll never build it high enough where you don't have temptation. But if you want to build a wall that is buffered, that would buffer temptation, it's important to keep your relationships in a place where you can be satisfied. And so that's why I'd like to talk to you about marriage for the next 3 or 4 weeks and singleness and marriage, probably a little more on the marriage end than the single part. I'd like to start from 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and I'd like to spend some time in here, in this passage. Now, I've never preached on the passages I'm going to preach on, and the reason why is because there's some tough things here. In fact, I've never in person heard anybody preach on this text, because Paul is very pointed. In some ways, he's very raw. There are a lot of passages of Scripture that are rated G. There are other passages that are probably rated R. This is probably a PG-13 passage. So I'm going to try to navigate it so that you don't have any unwanted questions from your 12-year-old on the way home. But just understand they probably know it anyway. But beginning in verse 1. Now concerning the things which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But I say this as a concession, not as a command. For I wish that all men were even as myself, but each one has his own gift from God, and in this manner, one in this manner, and another in that. Let's stop there for today. Paul is making some assertions, and one assertion that he makes in verse 1 is that it's okay to be single. I think that's what he's driving at when he says it's good for a man not to touch a woman. I don't think he's saying anything broader than that. He's making the assumption that if you are a single man, you are not touching a woman, and he says that's good. It's okay for a person to be single. Singleness is fine. He says later, I wish that everyone was like I am. And Paul was single. He says this later in verse 32 through 34, which is interesting. He's making the case that essentially you could be a better Christian if you were single. But I want you to be without care. He who is unmarried cares for the things of the Lord. Now, that's an assumption, by the way, not always the case, how he may please the Lord. But he who is married cares about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. There is a difference between a woman and a virgin. The unmarried woman cares about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and in spirit. But she who is married cares about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. Paul's saying, again, singleness is great. It's wonderful. You might even be a better Christian if you're single because you have more time to care about the things of the Lord. If you're married, you care about the things of your spouse, but if you're single, you can donate more time to the Lord. Christianity exalts singleness. In fact, Christianity is the only major religion in the world whose founder was single. That was Jesus Christ. Buddha had a wife or wives. Muhammad had wives. Confucius, if Confucianism is a religion, that's debatable, but he was married nonetheless. Judaism would trace itself back to Abraham, who was again married. Shintoism, Hinduism, that they don't have one specific founder, but all the major world religions had married founders, but Jesus Christ was single, which means that it can't be wrong to be single. I mean, Jesus was not lacking. It's sometimes in the church we look at single people as people with a plague. It's like, oh, they're living a lesser life than us, and they don't have the joys of fighting and making up like we do in a marriage. But single people, boy, they don't have it. But how could you say Jesus was lacking? How was Jesus lacking in any way? And he was single. So it's okay to be single. That's fine. That's great. Tell your mother, leave you alone. I'm single and I want to be single. And if you want grandkids, you're going to go adopt some kids. I'm fine. I'm single. It's great. I'm wonderful. The Bible says so. Then he goes on and he says, but it's okay to be married too. Verse 2, he says, let every man have his own wife, let every wife have her own husband. That's fine too. And we know that because who invented marriage? God invented marriage. And if God gave it, if God created it, it was part of his creation. And he looked at his creation and said, it is good. So God says, marriage is good. So that's great too. You're not sinning if you're married. But he does say this. This is what I want to zero in on in verse 3. He does say, but if you marry, you can't act like a single person. You got duties. Single is great. Married is great. But if you get married, you got duties. See, sometimes we beat up the single people and say, you're acting like you're married. You're acting like you're married. You guys can't be sleeping together. That's supposed to be in the marriage. You're acting like you're married. But Paul says, that's true. Sex ought to be inside of a marriage. That's true. If you're single, you can't act like a married person. But if you're married, you can't act like a single person either. You got duties. Your freedom is gone. You got to give what your wife is due her. And if you're a husband, a wife, you have to give what he is due. Now, the connotation of verse 3 is sexual, but there's a principle that comes out of verse 4. In verse 3, he says, if you're married, get married because talks about fornication in verse 2. So you need to get married and you need to give each other what is due each other. There's a sexual connotation there. And so you might put it like this. Paul is saying sex is only supposed to be in a marriage, but sex is supposed to be in a marriage. So if you don't like, you know, stay single. Right? Gosh, it's only supposed to be there, but it's supposed to be there. Okay. But it's bigger than that because he says, render unto her the affection due her. Now, affection is bigger than you know. Affection means kindness or goodwill. So it's just not about the physical, but he says, give her the kindness and goodwill that is due to her. She needs kindness. She needs goodwill. Give it that to her. You give it to him. Now, what does that mean? Well, I think what he means then is in verse 4, he comes in and he says, because you don't have authority over yourself and she doesn't have authority over herself. He says, so give each other what they're due, and primarily what they're due is authority over you. Give her what she's due. Give them what she's due. What are they due? Verse 4, they're due kindness, goodwill, and authority over you. That's what they're due. Now, a lot of times people want to jump right to Ephesians chapter 5 where it says, wives, submit yourselves unto your husbands. They forget that's in verse 22. Verse 21 says, submit yourselves one to another. Wives get it double. Wives, submit yourself unto your husbands. And they say, see, wives need to be submissive. But you know that's not what that text fully means, because then it comes back later and it says, and husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. And we know that love is not exclusively the responsibility of the husband. That text can't mean, husbands, love your wives. Wives, go ahead and hate the dog. It doesn't matter. Men aren't exclusively commanded to love their wives. Wives ought to love their husbands too. Men just get it double dose. It's like Paul is saying, men, love her. Men, love her. To the wives, he says, submit. Submit. But both have to do both. I mean, why, if a wife has to love, a husband has to submit too. And that's what Paul is saying here. He said, you're under the authority of your wife, husbands, and wives, you are under the authority of your husbands. Now, what does it mean to be under authority? I've never been in the military, but I've seen a lot of movies. And I think what authority means is priority. Because, again, I've just seen movies. I don't know this for a fact. But I think if you're a private and your sergeant sends you to do a job and you're going to do the job that the sergeant sent you to do and the colonel says, hey, go pick up my laundry, you got to go pick up his laundry. Because the colonel outranks the sergeant. The colonel has authority over the sergeant. So if both tell you to do something, you got to do what the colonel tells you to do, because, again, he has authority over the sergeant. He gets priority. He's got priority so that now the sergeant gets disregarded. It's now what the colonel wants. And if a general comes, you got to do what the general tells you to do, because he's got priority over the colonel. I think that's the way it works in the military, according to the movies. But in any case, authority, it means priority. So when the husband has authority over the wife, it means he gets priority in her life. And when she has authority over him, the bigger principle is that she gets priority in his life. And what that means then is that there is nothing that ought to trump them. They get veto power. They're the authority in your life, so that any other person means less to you than them. And if anyone else tells you to do something, they get priority to trump that. They get priority. They have the authority in your life. You say, well, you know, my job is very, very, very important to me. And, you know, it's very demanding. Your wife has priority over your job. You say, well, you know, my family is really important to me, and we do everything together. We vacation together. Everything's about my family. Well, your spouse has the authority over your family. And if it's between your spouse and your family, Paul's saying your spouse is going to have to win because they've got the authority. Your family's the major. Your spouse is the colonel. He outranks your family. You say, well, I got all these ambitions that I want to achieve. Yeah, your ambitions aren't the authority. Your spouse is the authority. And they outrank your ambitions. Now, both the husband and wife are then submitting, mutually submitting to each other in that way. Now that's a marriage. That's not dating. So if you're dating JJ, JJ wants to know where you're at all the time. JJ needs to go buy a ring, or better yet, you just need to get rid of JJ, because that don't even work in a marriage. But you don't have authority in dating. That's a great thing about being single. You don't have to render anything to anybody when you're single. I mean, there's no kindness even due, really, other than what Christians owe everybody. But if you're married, there is an authoritarian structure there. They get the priority in your life. It's very important for you to see. I remember reading about James Dobson in his book, Bringing Up Boys. He talked about his mother calling his father once. His father was a traveling evangelist, and he was a very accomplished traveling evangelist and spent his life on the road preaching in very large venues. And he was of some acclaim in his circle. And James Dobson was getting into his teen years, and his mother primarily raised him while his dad traveled. And he said, my mom called my dad once when I was 15, 16, and said, I need help raising Jimmy. You got to come home now. And he said, my dad quit this profession, if you will, as his traveling evangelist with a great deal of acclaim to it. He had 3 years worth of revival scheduled out into the future. He was in great demand. He canceled 3 years of revivals. He went home, pastored a fairly small church, much below his level. I mean, he could have pastored larger churches. He could have made more money, but he took this thing that was beneath him, because his wife called him and said, you got to come home now. I need help raising Jimmy. That's what it means to be under the authority of your mate. You have a job, you have a career, you have this. But when she calls and says, you must come home now, you come home. You have to be under the authority of that person. They have to have your priority. They have to be your priority. Now, sometimes, and maybe oftentimes, one mate will look at the other and say, I'm not your priority. And the other mate will say, yes, you are. Now, usually it's the wife looking at the husband saying, I'm not your priority. And he looks back and says, yes, you are. I just have to say this, and I feel like I'm betraying my race of people here. But 95% of the time, the person who says, I'm not your priority, is probably right. They're probably right. There's a guy named Jay Stone who was a psychiatrist, and he wrote a book a while back, and he said, there's something inside of human beings, even when they're raised in a loveless home, even when they're raised in a home where love is in many ways perverted and they don't understand what love really is. He said there's something deep inside of human beings that know the difference between false and true love. There's something there that instinctively they know when they're being used or when they're being loved freely for who they are. Now, you can suppress that. And sometimes people get into a relationship where they're maybe dating somebody and everybody's saying he's using you. He doesn't love you, but you're suppressing that because you want him to love you so badly because you're in love with him that you ignore what your heart and what your gut is telling you. But it's in there. You know when you're not somebody's priority. You know when they're using you. There's something in there. So when somebody looks at you and says, I'm not your priority, they're probably right and you're probably very wrong. And if they look at you and say that, you need to respond to that. Because all the other things you do in a marriage won't supplement you being a lack of priority or them being your lack of priority. If they get the sense that I'm not their priority, the job matters more, the kids matter more, their family matters more. If they ever get the hint that things matter more than them, there is nothing you're going to do to fix that problem other than address it. There's no way to supplement over here. You can't spend your way out of that problem. And you're going to have to hear what they have to say, because if you're in a relationship with a person, particularly a marriage, and you're not their priority, what it does is it cuts you to the core. It's a great insult because you have given them everything. You have invested in them. And essentially they have looked at you and said, everything that you have given to me, everybody you turned down to marry me, every sacrifice you have made in this relationship isn't good enough for me to make you a priority in my life. And what it does is it is a demeaning thing to be in a relationship and you've done everything. You have given them the best years of your life. You have maybe raised their kids for them. You have stood by them through thick and thin. You have defended them and now their job is worth more than you are. It's an attack on their sense of self-worth. And that'll get deep in there. That is a burr. That is something that gets deep in a person's soul and it hurts and it will be inflamed and they can't think about it too much because it hurts too bad. And you can spend your way, you can take them on vacation, you can do a lot of different things, but if you don't fix that part of it, you are not going to have a very good marriage. They have to be your priority. The husband has authority. He has priority over the wife. The wife, she has priority over her husband, Paul says. Let me read to you. Just this will take maybe 4 minutes to read. I timed it. This is James Dobson. Interesting question. He's a counselor, right? And so the question is asking him, what is the most common marital problem you hear about in your office? What's the most common problem people have in marriage? So this is what he says. He says, let's suppose I have a counseling appointment at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon with a person whom I've never met. Who is that person and what will be the complaint that brings them to me? First, the patient will probably be Mrs. Jones, not her husband. A man is seldom the first to seek marriage counseling, and when he does, it is for a different motive than when his wife seeks it. She comes because her marriage is driving her crazy. He comes because his wife is driving him crazy. Miss Jones will be perhaps between the age of 28 and 42 years old, and her problem will be extremely familiar to me. Though the details will vary, the frustration she communicates on that afternoon will conform to a well-worn pattern. It will sound something like this. John and I were deeply in love when we got married. We struggled during the first 2 or 3 years, especially with financial problems, but I knew he loved me and I knew I loved him, but then something began to change. I'm not sure how to describe it. He received a promotion about 5 years ago, and that required him to work longer hours. We needed the money, so we didn't mind the extra time he was putting in, but it never stopped. Now he comes home late every evening. He's so tired I can actually hear his feet dragging as he approaches the porch. I look forward to his coming home all day because I have so much to tell him, but he doesn't feel much like talking. So I fix his dinner and he eats alone. I usually eat with the kids earlier in the evening. After dinner, John makes a few phone calls and works at his desk. Frankly, I like to hear him talk on the phone just so I can hear his voice. And then he watches TV for a couple of hours and goes to bed. Except on Tuesday nights, he plays basketball, and sometimes he has a meeting at the office, and every Saturday morning, he plays golf with three friends. Then on Sunday, we are in church most of the day. Believe me, there are times when we go for a month or two without having a real in-depth conversation. You know what I mean? And I get so lonely in the house with three kids climbing all over me. There aren't any other women in the neighborhood I can talk to because most have gone back to work. But there are other irritations about John. He rarely takes me out to dinner, and he forgot our anniversary last month, and I honestly don't believe he's ever had a romantic thought. He wouldn't know a rose from a carnation, and his Christmas cards are signed just John. There's no closeness or warmth between us, yet he wants to, well, you know, with me at the end of the day, there we are lying in bed, having had no communication between us for weeks. He hasn't tried to be sweet or understanding or tender, yet he expects me to be passionate and responsive to me. Sure, I go along with my duties as a wife, but I sure don't get anything out of it. I lie there resenting him and feeling like a prostitute. Can you believe that? I feel used for having sex with my own husband, and boy, does that depress me. In fact, I've been awfully depressed lately. My self-esteem is rock bottom right now, and I feel like nobody loves me. I'm a lousy mother and a terrible wife. Sometimes I think that God probably doesn't love me either. Well, now, I'd better tell you what's been going on between John and me more recently. We've been arguing a lot. I mean, really fighting. It's the only way I can get his attention, I guess. We had a terrible fight last week in front of the kids. It was awful. Tears, screaming, insults, everything. I spent two nights at my mother's house. Now, all I can think about is getting a divorce so I can escape. John doesn't love me anyway, so what difference would it make? I guess that's why I came to see you. I want to know if I'd be doing the right thing if I call it quits. This is what Dobson says in the final paragraph. Miss Jones speaks as though she was the only woman in the world who has ever experienced this pattern of needs. But she is not alone, and it is my guess that 90% of divorces that occur each year involve at least some of the elements she described: an extremely busy husband who is in love with his work and who tends to be somewhat insensitive, unromantic, and non-communicative, married to a lonely, vulnerable, romantic woman who has severe doubts about her worth as a human being. They become a match team. He works like a horse, and she nags. What's all that about? It's about priority. It's about a woman who knows, or at least feels in her gut, that she's not her husband's priority. It's his career for a wife. It could be the kids are more important to her than the husband, and I think that's pretty common, and you hear that a lot from guys. She just married me to have kids, and once she had the kids, I became a paycheck to her. I hear stuff like that, but it is about priority. And until they are your priority, all the other stuff is just Band-Aids. All the other stuff is just Band-Aids. Men, you might have to work a little less than you're working. I know you got a lot of friends, but you might need to spend your Saturdays at home. You might need to be there. Women, I know you got a lot. You got family, and you got sisters, and you got a mother. Now, if he's getting home at 4 or 5 o'clock, you might want to spend most of your nights at home. If he wants the time, you might ought to give him the time. You ought not maybe think that he's second rate to your mother. It is about priority, and priorities, it can be a hobby, it can be people, it can be an ambition, it can be a job, it can be a lot of different things, it can be some strange things, but until they know they're your priority, everything else is probably going to be Band-Aids. Paul says, listen, get married, render to each other what is due to each other, in kindness and in goodwill and in authority. You need to do that for each other. He finishes up, and this is where I'll finish tonight, in verse 7. He says, each person has their own gift. That's very interesting, isn't it? Because gift there is actually the Greek word for grace. And he says, some of you are single, and that's your gift. Some of you are married, and that's your gift. Each one has their own grace. I wonder if, in closing, if you could see your singleness and your married state as a gift from God. That'd be a good start. Do the other stuff, but begin with thanksgiving for God. You say, I don't want to be single. Well, we don't always like the gifts of God. Don't always like them, but they're always good for us. You know, if you're single, it means you have a simpler lifestyle. Life is really simple. I mean, if you're busy and single, something's wrong. Something's just wrong. You have a simpler lifestyle. You have more opportunities. You have less responsibility in your life. And I know maybe you want somebody and you want that companionship and you want to be married and you crave that. And I understand that. But for this moment in your life, you're single. And you might get up and instead of bemoaning the fact that you're single, you might get up and say, thank you for the gift of singleness today. Thank you that I don't have the responsibilities I'll see other mothers have as they drag four kids down the sidewalk. Thank God that that's not me. Thank you for the opportunities. I'm thankful for the lack of responsibilities. I can do more. I have time. I can serve the Lord in ways that maybe I couldn't have served Him with that responsibility. I'm thankful for my singleness. I accept it as a gift at this moment in my life. Now, if I'm 35, I might be pretty resentful about the gift. But accept it. And if you're married, see that as a gift. You know, if you're married, you should have a deeper level of intimacy. There is that relationship that others may not have, and then that's a nice thing. You know, Paul will talk forever in Ephesians 5 how marriage is a tool of sanctification, and marriage can make you holy. And that's a gift. I mean, one of the functions of marriage is that it reveals who you are. I mean, it's easy to say, well, you know what? I'm just a nice, easygoing fella. I can get along with anybody. Well, you haven't been married yet. You haven't been married yet. You'll find out that there's a little bit of pride coming out of that statement right there. You haven't been married yet. It's easy to say, well, you know what? I'm an even-tempered person. I'm never angry. Nothing gets under my skin. Well, get married. Get married. And then marriage will reveal the need, and it will help sanctify you in that area of your life. It's easy to think you're any number of things until you get married, and marriage has a wonderful way of revealing who you are, and if you respond appropriately, helping to sanctify you in areas that you probably would not have been as sanctified when you were single. You just thought you were that way, but you really weren't. You were just proud. But marriage can make you something that maybe you would have never been if you were single. But accept that as a gift. If you're married, it's a gift. It's grace of God poured out on you. Receive it. If you're single, it's a gift. Can you own it as a gift? If you can own it as a gift, that's the first step towards contentment where you're at. Will you stand with me?